You're listening to BQN. Assimilate the audio.
Welcome, listeners, to another episode of All Good Things, the Star Trek Universe podcast here on BQN. I'm your host, Mark White, and with me today is Christos Giannaris. Hi, Christos. Welcome back.
Hey, Mark. How you doing? Welcome back to you.
I was absent last week, which, as Amy pointed out, I think it was the first time I've been absent since I started last November. It was nice to have a little bit of a break. I went up to Maine and did some camping and saw some family and very old dear friends. So it was a great trip.
Yeah, I saw some of your pictures. It looked like you had a good time.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and my doggie did too. I brought my doggie.
It was nice to have some one-on-one time with Amy last week, but glad to have you back.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, Christos, do you have any news happening this week in Star Trek? What's going on?
Oh, just a little bit of news this week. We finally got a release date for Lower Decks Season 3, which is August 25th. Hold the suspense. But, it's a little bit longer break than I think most of us thought we'd have between the finale of Strange New Worlds last week and the beginning of Lower Decks. But, you know, it's about a 7-8 week stretch. Gives a lot of podcasters a break. But I'm really looking forward to Lower Deck Season 3, finding out what happens to Captain Freeman.
Oh, absolutely. They left us at cliffhanger, and I know. So I'm excited to see how they resolve that.
Popular cliffhanger, huh? I mean, in the sense that they just did it on Strange New Worlds, too. Tactic. Yeah. showing up and arresting somebody important, and boom, season's over.
So do you think that, well, you can comment on both shows. Do you think that on either show they will resolve it relatively quickly, given the nature of the episodic storytelling they're doing?
I feel like on Lower Decks, 1 to 2 episodes, it'll be fixed. I don't see it being a season-long tie-through because there wouldn't be a lot for Dawn Lewis to do if she were just locked up the whole season. She's the voice of Captain Freeman. It is Captain Freeman, right? I'm not making that up.
No, it is.
Okay. Sorry. I am due for a rewatch, and that's kind of what I'm going to be probably doing between now and the premiere. Although the other bit of news is not news, but we're only 6 days away from the big Star Trek panel at SDCC, and I'm sure we'll have a lot of Star Trek news break that day. So that's, for me, that's another thing that's got me really excited.
Do you think they will release some trailers for the upcoming seasons? What are your thoughts?
Oh, yeah. We talked a little bit about this last week. But, yes, I predict definitely Picard, either a trailer or a teaser trailer. But, you know, those can be pretty ambiguous these days as to what's a teaser and what's a real trailer. I think for Lower Decks, we'll get a full-blown trailer because we only did get a little teaser back there in April. And then I don't know. The more I think about Strange New Worlds, the more I think that perhaps we might get a clip or some photos, you know, a little nugget on story. So there's that. I also have given it more thought since last week. With Picard now done and we're just waiting to air the season, you know, we're technically only 4 shows in production. I mean, I know they're still doing post-production on Picard, but it's wrapped. You know, the writer's room is closed, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be surprised if they don't announce what the next thing is. They've been hinting at Section 31. They've been hinting at a Starfleet Academy show and some other ideas that we don't even know. So we may get an update on what the new 5th show is going to be. We could get some Star Trek movie news. There could be other projects which have been discussed. So I think there may be news outside of the 3 shows that are on the panel.
Yeah, that would make sense.
Yeah.
And be very, very exciting.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I'm actually going to be there with my best friend Mitch next week, so I'm really excited.
Ah, You get all the hookups.
Thanks, Gays in Space.
Well, now it's time for All Good World.
From Las Vegas to Boston, USA to Canada and South America, from the United Kingdom to South Africa, from Russia to Australia, the South Pacific and beyond, this is All Good World.
Each episode, we highlight a different location around the globe where this podcast has reached. Today's episode, we'd like to give a special shout-out to Austria. Fun fact, following the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand in 1914, Emperor Franz Joseph declared war on Serbia, which ultimately escalated into World War I. The empire's defeat and subsequent collapse led to the proclamation of the Republic of German Austria in 1918, and later the First Austrian Republic in 1919. During the interwar period, anti-parliamentarian sentiments culminated in the formation of an Austro-fascist dictatorship under Engelbert Dollfuss in 1934, a year before the outbreak of World War II. Austria was annexed into Nazi Germany by Adolf Hitler, and it became a subnational division. Following its liberation in 1945 and an extended period of Allied occupation, the country regained its sovereignty and declared its perpetual neutrality in 1955. Well, you've actually been to Austria, right?
Yeah, it's been a really long time. I was on a trip in high school with something like I saved up for, my parents helped contribute to. So the summer between my freshman and sophomore year, I got to go to Europe for 3 weeks and with a group of students. And I was one of the youngest ones in the group. It was mostly juniors and seniors, but I mean, it's to 6 different countries. So it was a lot of fun. But Austria was one of them. And I just remember it being very beautiful. Very clean. It's one of those countries I want to get back to. I was also like, it was Austria and Switzerland that I think impressed me the most when I was on that trip. So,
Definitely worth checking out on my next European vacation, too. Yeah. I'd love to go.
Definitely. If anything, you can go see where they film The Sound of Music.
I'd have to take a helicopter ride, right? Isn't that how you get up there?
I think so.
Yeah. I'd just spin and spin and spin until I fell over.
Yeah. Make sure you take a drone, so we got to get that, you know.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, this week, we are going to introduce a new topic. I know, get out of town. It's like we never do this.
this is a good one.
Yeah, thank you. This one is part one of Get Off My Ship series. In this series, we will explore the action-adventure side of Trek with our favorite crew members must take back their ship or station from an invading force. This is the inaugural episode, so we will be discussing Voyager's Message in a Bottle, where the Doctor must retake the Prometheus, a prototype Federation vessel, from the Romulans.
Nice, nice. Yeah, really good topic. This happens kind of a lot in Trek, so there's lots of episodes to fuel this. I was surprised you went with Get Off My Ship. Sorry. I'm surprised you went with Message in a Bottle and not Basics Part 1 and 2 to bring in Voyager, but I'm sure that's later in the series, listeners. Message in a Bottle, it's a fun episode, so I'm glad we get to talk about that today.
Yeah, I love, one of the reasons I love Voyager so much is for the Doctor, and it's a very Doctor-centric episode, and I think that's why I ended up on the list.
Yeah. No, it is a very Doctor-centric episode, and, you know, honestly, unpopular opinion, I mean, I like the Doctor, but he's not my favorite. I don't dislike him, but he's just kind of there. I know other people just love the Doctor. It's like one of their favorite characters overall in all of Trek, but I do like him in this episode, though. I feel like he's very well used.
He's also, at this point, you know, this is season 4, midway through season 4. He's really come into his own. I think it's a nice juxtaposition with Andy Dick's Mark II, because when he starts off, he's very reminiscent of the Mark I when he's first initiated.
Yes.
He is that super kind of annoying, scared doctor. And so it's neat. You get to actually see, well, I'll just call him the Mark II's growth with, you know, the Mark I. I mean, yeah, the Mark I's growth with Mark II standing next to him. There we go.
No, you had it right, and then you just reversed it again. Yeah. Oh. Yeah, Mark II's growth because of the influence of Mark I.
There we go.
There we go. Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Like I said, it is a really good episode for the Doctor. And you're right. You know, when they first created the character of the Doctor and we see him in Caretaker, he is very different than he grew into be. And I think they even realized they kind of painted themselves in a little bit of a corner with him. His inability to leave the sick bay set, they found a way to resolve that and other things like, you know, to be able to utilize the character better, because just having him stuck to the sick bay set was too limiting.
Yeah, absolutely. And that must have been, you know, frustrating for Robert Picardo, because he couldn't, for the first, what, season, he couldn't really get to any other sets. He was sort of stuck in sick bay. He was limited to the interaction he had with the rest of the crew. You know, he was a main cast member, but he really couldn't do that much. So that mobile emitter brought a lot to his character.
Yeah, and we see that kind of resolved in the Prometheus, where future Federation ships have holographic emitters all throughout. So their EMHs can be everywhere on the ship, that is.
And then you get to, you know, Picard, and it's getting more standardized in even non-Federation ships, where they've realized that it is handy to be able to have a holographic assistant in various capacities throughout the ship.
Yep, they have the holographic workforce.
Well, how did we get from there to here? So it's interesting how they set up this episode, because, you know, obviously Voyager being stuck in the Delta Quadrant, there wasn't, at least for the most part, the first few seasons, any interactions with the Alpha Quadrant. And so the way that they structured this episode and wrote it, I thought was really cool. How they tied in, you know, one of the main cast members from Voyager and got him over into the Alpha Quadrant to save the day. How do you think they did that? I mean, did you like that?
I did like how they did it, and I probably have a few comments about it, but I don't know. Maybe we should give the listeners a quick little recap of the episode real fast. So the overall plot is pretty simple. I'm just going to do this kind of like from my head. Is Seven of Nine discovers a sensor array that they believe to be abandoned, and it's so vast that they can see into the Alpha Quadrant, and she actually finds a Federation starship moving along in space, and it is the Prometheus. And they attempt to send a message, and that does not work, and I can't remember if it was B'Elanna or somebody else decides that, hey, maybe something with a little bit more weight to it, like a holographic type file, could get through. So they figure out that there's a really good chance that if they had bundled up the Doctor, they could send his program through the network and have it materialize on this other Federation starship in the Alpha Quadrant, and he could basically advocate for what's going on Voyager. And it works. They do it. They rush it really fast, because of course with everything in Star Trek, time is working against us. They only have a little bit of time before the ship gets out of the sensor range. The Doctor gets there only to find out that every Starfleet crew member has been murdered and the ship has been taken over by Romulans. And I guess from there, hijinks ensue. The Doctor decides he needs to be a part of taking back that ship and saving the Prometheus from falling into Romulan hands. So he activates the EMH of that ship, which is now an EMH-2, a higher model than the Doctor. They will talk about their relationship, but eventually they work together to first take back the ship and then defend the ship in a battle with three Romulan warbirds. And at the end, everybody lives happily ever after. The Doctor gets to brief Starfleet on what's been going on with Voyager, and then they mail the Doctor back through the network and updates the Voyager crew about what happened. Do you think I got it all?
I think you did a great job. It wasn't too long, wasn't too short. It was, yeah.
Well, I was skipping some details there because we're going to talk about some of the details as we go here. So we'll fill in the blanks. But listeners, hopefully that refreshes your memory if you did not get a chance to rewatch. You know, the Doctor being a particular file that can't be copied and recreated, it has always been a little bit of a convenient plot hole or plot device of, you know, why we don't have more just like the Doctor. If the Doctor truly is a file that lives in Voyager's computer, why can't they just copy and paste? And suddenly you have two. Because, like, for example, we do run into the problem of the Doctor's now not on the ship, and we have no Doctor on Voyager. And one of the many B-plots is Kim and Paris trying to build a new Doctor. And the risk, of course, is high then, because if the Doctor's only one file, if something happens to him, happens to that file, then, you know, he's gone, for a better word. And downloading him and transmitting him, you know, 60,000 light years is a big risk. And because what, you know, and I feel like it's taken, they use the plot device of time ticking, and we have to make a decision now. It's now or never. This is our only chance to kind of maybe justify taking the extreme risk of losing the Doctor's file. Okay, we just got to do this. We don't have time to think about it. And so they do it, and it works. But I always thought it was a little lame that the Doctor's file cannot be copied and recreated.
Yeah, I see where you're coming from, and I don't disagree with you. But I think that putting the limitation on there makes it for more interesting storytelling, because otherwise they could just,
plot device, plot hole, whatever you want to call it. It's on purpose to kind of not be able to immediately, as a viewer, or you know, give an alternate solution and boom, episode's over.
Well, this episode I think is enjoyable on a lot of levels. This, you know, is one of the few episodes where I feel like Star Trek dips its toe into the comedy waters. I know for me, I noticed a lot of that with The Next Generation. There were some playful moments, but I didn't, I guess, see any kind of outright, like, this episode was written for comedy that often. And here we have an episode that was really like, this was Star Trek trying to be funny and actually being successful at it. I think the pairing with Robert Picardo and Andy Dick was great. I think that even what was happening between B'Elanna and Seven was great. There was funny moments there. You got funny moments in the Doctor's office in the med bay between Harry Kim and Paris. And so there was a lot of comedy happening all the way around. And I don't know, did you have some favorite moments from that?
Yeah, I think my favorite pairing would be the Doctor and Andy Dick's character, EMH 1 and 2. They both kind of have this dry, curmudgeon-type personality. And they're very much like the two old guys on The Muppet Show. That's, you know. it also reminded me a little bit of Frasier and Niles from The Frasier Show, just the kind of way they kind of pick on each other at this kind of higher level of intellect. And but, you know, ultimately, you kind of, you know, they fit the typical team building formation. You know, they say that, you know, when a team forms, you have, you know, four stages. You have form, storm, norm, and perform. And I feel like in this very short episode, we see EMH 1 and 2 go through those four stages. That's very much work talk for you. Sorry, it's the Lean Six Sigma type thing. It's something I do on the side. But yeah, they definitely go through those four phases of a team, and they make quite the comedic duo. Like I said, they wrote, you know, the humor was intentional, but they do pull it off. And you're right, Seven is always funny with her dry humor, and I do enjoy this. Probably my second favorite, besides what's going on the Prometheus, I do enjoy what's going on between B'Elanna and Seven in this episode quite a bit.
When she initially just sent that feedback thing through the network and shocked the Hirogen. And I don't know if it was B'Elanna or Janeway was just like, you know, you killed him. And then Seven just dryly like, it was a mild shock. He will recover.
Yeah.
It was just so funny.
Yeah.
I laugh every time I see that.
Yeah. Seven has that like kind of deadpan delivery on everything she does. And it really resonates. That's probably one of the biggest differences between, I call old Seven and new Seven is, you know, this old Seven is very dry, very deadpan. But 20 years later in Picard, she's so much more evolved and she's kind of, you know, she's more human for sure. Her human side just really has come out. But I do like early Seven a lot for that. You know, and that's really the whole point of the exchanges between B'Elanna and Seven in this episode is just how rude Seven comes off, because she's so direct and she doesn't use pleasantries. And, you know, she may be right, but it just that comes off as being rude or condescending at times. And that's what B'Elanna is trying to help her with in this episode.
Isn't that a little ironic, though, that B'Elanna is the one trying to help her with that? When
you know,
you go back to season one, she was the one that was so abrasive.
When B'Elanna is setting the line that somebody is rude, you know it's bad. exactly. Interesting little, you know, it kind of probably belongs in the trivia thing here, but in this episode is the first time we see B'Elanna wear the engineering jacket, which was very similar to Dr. Crusher's lab coat. B'Elanna's engineering jacket is worn to cover up Roxanne Dawson's pregnancy in real life. So that's why she's wearing that jacket throughout pretty much here and the rest of season four. And you can even tell it's kind of even made of the same linen fabric that Beverly Crusher's lab coat was made of, for all you little uniform expert people out there.
Yeah, I loved that. I thought it was appropriate. It's a little bit also Miles O'Brien, how Miles had the special uniform made so he can roll up his sleeves while he's working. And I got that from B'Elanna as well, as, you know, this was a more utilitarian kind of jacket. Also, the nod to her Klingon heritage, which she, you know, historically has run from, but you see a little bit of it, you know, appear on the jacket, like a Worf's sash or something. She has those little emblems. I don't know what they mean, but I know that it's a part of her heritage.
Is it? I thought they were tools, but I could be completely wrong.
I thought they were just little pins for like Klingon pins. That'd be
listeners, interesting. Listeners, tell us, are those Klingon ornament decorations very similar to Worf's, or is that engineering tools? Let us know.
Yeah, love to find out.
So, Mark, do you know what the connection between this week's All Good Things and last week's All Good Things is? There is a major connection.
You put that in the notes and I was very confused, so please enlighten us.
All right. So listeners, if you recall last week, Amy and I did a little bit of medical ethics discussion on the TNG season one episode of Symbiosis. So you'll recall we talked about the one of the Brekkians, Sobi, who was in that episode, was Jo Chim from Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. This is all played by Judson Scott. Judson Scott made his third appearance in all of Star Trek universe one more time. And it was actually in this week's episode, Message in a Bottle, he played Wrecker, the Romulan commander who has taken over the Prometheus. So, like I said, I don't know what the chances are that this actor was randomly in both episodes, because when I think you guys were programming the topics, nothing like that is ever taken into account. It's not like you were doing this character deep dive on Judson Scott, but there you go.
No, I assure you, it was completely random, but I love that. That's so awesome.
800 and some episodes in Star Trek television, and you guys got this one. It's not like he's a Jeffrey Combs, right, who's been in like 30, 40, 50 episodes, you know, or Varun Armstrong, somebody like that, you know. Okay, so maybe that's possible. But yeah, he only did two Star Trek episodes ever, and we picked the two in a row. Anyways, and I felt like he did a really good job as Wrecker, the Romulan commander. I was watching, and the first thing I caught was his eyes, and I'm like, there's no way that that's what's his face. And of course, you know, I bust out my Voyager companion, and yep, that's him.
Well, that's an awesome connection, and I think you've blown some minds this week with that little bit of trivia.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know mine was.
Yeah. It's totally random, but we'll take it. It's kind of fun.
This story is really interesting. This is one of my go-to favorite Voyager episodes because, like I said, I really love the Doctor's character, so I tend to gravitate towards the Doctor-centric episodes. But what's really unique about this is the fact that, you know, if you just look at it on the page, what sort of a harrowing tale this is and how serious it is, because, you know, after 4 years of being lost in space, essentially, this is their first glimmer of hope to talk to the Alpha Quadrant, and there's a lot riding on it. And as you said, there's a small window of time. Then you know, the Doctor gets over to the ship and it's overrun by Romulans. And are we going to lose him? Like, is this going to be the last of the Doctor? Like, you don't know going into this episode. And it can be heavy if you look at it that way. But they really do a good job of balancing that weight and that heaviness with the levity. And so it's kind of fun from a lot of different angles. And yeah, anyway.
Yeah, it's a high-stakes episode for sure, while having a lot of comedy going on in the middle. Mm. And you're right. You know, you do see them trying to build a new Doctor on Voyager. We could have easily, like, rebooted the Doctor's character by saying, well, he got back to the Alpha Quadrant, but we didn't get him back. But there's a new Doctor, and they could have easily introduced a new EMH and given him a whole different personality that would in turn then kind of reboot the character in general. And that could have been done. That wouldn't have been a far stretch of the mind, because it's not like you're killing an actor off the show or something. Mm-hmm. You know, you would just... So at the end of the day, there are some different ways this episode could have ended that were entirely plausible. And so, yeah, the high stakes of the episode is definitely felt. I did enjoy, finally, as a Voyager watcher, I missed... The one thing I don't like about Voyager, or maybe not don't like, that's very strong, missed in Voyager, is, of course, the contact with Starfleet and just being... They're not lost in space, per se, but, yeah, they're too far to communicate. They're too far from home. The mission of getting the ship home. So this is the first time, of course, we do, you know, make contact with the Federation, and Voyager does get an update of what's happening in the Alpha Quadrant, and that's kind of cool. Episodes like this, I love the Omega Directive, because once again, that kind of gives Janeway orders from Starfleet, even though they're already set years before. But suddenly, like, we're on a Federation, it's almost like we're on a mission from Starfleet, kind of TNG episode of the week with Omega Directive. And then this leads to other episodes like Pathfinder, which Pathfinder is like one of my favorite Voyager episodes, because that's where they finally make contact with voice contact with the Federation. It's the Barclays in that episode and whatnot. So, yeah, so we get to see a little bit of what's going on with the Federation. And of course, we're with the Federation. Deep Space Nine was on concurrently when this episode was made. We're well into the Dominion War. So lots going on there as well. And just seeing a brand new starship and some new sets, or maybe not so new sets, being used. It's some really cool design that I don't think we even saw again, did we? Like, let's talk about the Prometheus a little bit.
Not to my knowledge. I noticed at the beginning when they first showed the ship, before you saw the numbers, you saw that it was an NX class ship, which, if you're a Star Trek fan, you recognize NX class as being a prototype ship, one of a kind kind of a thing. And the, you know, the Enterprise NX was the prototype, warp 5 engine in it. And then you have this NX, you know, class ship, which was the first time you've seen a Starfleet vessel. You've seen a Starfleet vessel separate like a saucer section before, but now this is a ship separating into three different parts, all of which can operate kind of independently to form a small little, you know, armada of three.
So let's just talk about that real fast, because I have a bone to pick about multi-vector assault mode, as they call it in the episode. I don't mind the fact that the ship splits into three pieces. In fact, I think that's very brilliant and very cool. I'm not quite sure how the ship maintained its high warp while it was separated and engaged another ship in battle. The ship splits into three pieces, two of which have two warp nacelles each. So maybe I can buy that piece one and piece two can maintain warp. Maybe how do they maintain such a high warp? I don't know. But one piece is just a kind of triangle piece of the saucer section. And we've heard about ships extending warp fields and warp bubbles and things like that, and carrying along ships, like it happened in Enterprise in a really cool scene. But I feel like it wasn't addressed, but I feel like the ship should have slowed down or fallen out of warp or something. Especially the one piece. And, you know, it's not like, the, you know, every time we've ever seen warp bubbles be shared, it's always a very tricky thing and dangerous. And, you know, but in this particular scene, as the Prometheus is engaging that Nebula class ship in warp, in multi-vector assault mode, it maintains the all three pieces are kind of moving around in that really cool tactical type of engagement, but we are still maintaining almost warp 9.9 and nobody falls out of warp. And I almost feel like you probably need the combined power of all those nacelles and the ship being joined to be maintaining that high warp. So that's my nitpick for this episode, probably the biggest one. Listeners, am I wrong? What do you think, Mark?
I agree with you. that makes sense, that it probably wouldn't be able to sustain the high warp. When I was watching the episode, I didn't really catch that. I was wasn't really thinking.
Well,
about
you weren't supposed to.
I think I would just suspend my belief enough.
Okay. So you can look past it very easily.
Yeah.
That's okay. I'll take that. I mean, we're supposed to. I mean, obviously, it's like it's a plot thing, but and maybe there is some sort of techno babble that explains why they didn't. So I'd be interested. Like I said, if anybody else has thoughts on that, please let me know. But I feel like that doesn't hold up from what we've seen and what we know about warp travel and warp fields and throughout Trek canon. But yeah, it's an experimental ship. It's, I think, 27 crew members, and then like only 4 or 5 know how to operate it, which seems it makes sense to me that in the midst of the Dominion War, yes, we're probably doing some major R&D and coming up with some stuff that's going to hopefully help give us the tactical advantage. And all I'll say is I don't feel like, did we see this ever in DS9? I don't think we did.
No. Did not see the Prometheus.
There is a, I'm not sure if it's a Prometheus class vessel, at the very final scene of Voyager, as the ships are escorting Voyager to Earth. You do see one of the many starships that are in that pack. But so yes, we probably get past the prototype and see it again. But tactical mode is maybe a lost. Lost opportunity for DS9. It's probably also a very expensive special effect, you know, to be pulling out.
Yeah.
And anyway, so Prometheus has been taken over, and that's kind of getting back to the topic of our of our episode. And the plot is, if, you know, of course, time is running out. We need to take the ship back before it gets to Romulan space. And yeah, we see the Doctor and the EMH kind of come together and really kind of go from despising each other. You know, EMH2 looks down on EMH1 because he feels like he is a substandard version. And EMH1 mm-hmm. is offended that Starfleet would go and make, oh, no, you're outdated, you're obsolete, we need to go build an EMH, a better version of you. And the Doctor's like, that would be somehow kind of implying he's imperfect. So they're kind of offended at the whole idea of the existence of each other. Mm-hmm. And that, I think that's kind of funny because, you know, like, I guess obviously holograms have feelings. And, you know, it's really kind of cute for me. but it does go to show, in the EMH2, I give them credit, they bring them around pretty fast, that leaving the EMH1 running for 4 years straight has led to development and evolution in the character, or in the hologram's ability, and kind of like from a learning AI standpoint, if you look at it like that. And mm-hmm. that EMH2 does accept that EMH1 has evolved and is maybe a better version of himself by the end of the episode.
Well, they discuss that in Voyager. There, yeah. I know they at least had like one episode where the program was degrading and they were going to lose him, and they had to figure out a way to prolong his program being run, and they had to, you know, briefly transfer him onto the holodeck for a little while they fixed him. But yeah, I remember they did sort of touch on that, and so that was a nice plot device that they threw in there, and I'm glad they sort of, you know, nodded to it in this episode. I was like, yeah, they had to do that.
Yeah, for sure, and it really is well worked. You do realize that I think a lot of the sets that we see on the Prometheus, I'm like, did they go build all of this for this episode? Because it's a really snazzy looking starship, right? It's I don't know if I like that it's all white or cream on the inside, but it does look very I think it's designed to look nice and new, and you know, maybe this was our first glimpse of the Abrams universe was to come in another 10 years. I was reading that these are a lot of redresses of the Enterprise E set.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of thought when you see the Doctor going into the Jefferies tube, I'm like, well, that's the same Jefferies tube that Dr. Crusher goes in First Contact, which I believe is also, I think, in First Contact. Wasn't the sick bay set the actual Voyager set?
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Yes. Yes, I believe it was.
Yeah, and then they built a new sick bay for Nemesis. But anyway, so I give a lot of credit to the production of being able to take a set and redress it, and suddenly we're on a whole other ship. That's pretty cool. Because you do see the similarities, but and you're like, for the most part, I was like, wow, they built all of this, but they didn't. But mm-hmm. And the ability to redress like that. There's obviously probably some painting that goes on and whatnot. And if that was the Enterprise E bridge, they had to put it back to the way it was.
Right?
Yeah.
This episode marks the first appearance of the Hirogen on the series, and I didn't realize while I was watching it, but this was the first time we saw the Hirogen. And so I thought that was cool, because this ended up being the big bad for at least a couple of seasons on Voyager.
Yeah, a couple of... And I think it actually is the very next episode where the Hirogen are back. Mm-hmm. And it's because of this contact and using their array that they've made themselves known to the Hirogen. So, and of course, you know, Seven probably picked a little fight with one of them. But there's some really good foreshadowing like this that happens in Voyager. I think that they were being very, you could definitely tell they had good showrunners. And I think Brandon Braga was the showrunner at this point. That there was some definite thought going on and planning multi-arc, even though the show was very much still an episode of the week type of Star Trek with this ongoing theme of trying to get home. They were laying things for things to come. And I love that the Hirogen just kind of show up here, and then sure enough, they're the next week, they're were having our first major encounter with them.
And it was a cool idea for a species that, you know, they are just like, I don't know, wolves.
Yeah.
They just live for the hunt. And their ships are decorated with skulls and things. I mean, we've, you know, had the Klingons, which are, you know, very much...
I was just
going
to say that. They're
centric like
they're...
with the battle.
Yep.
But, you know, the Klingons, as much as they talk about battles and things, they're also... They like to party and they do other things, you know. They're food. I would consider them a foodie culture. They have a lot of different cuisines and drinks. And so as much as they do enjoy you know, having battles, their culture is a little bit less sort of one note than maybe the Hirogen.
Yeah. All I could think was with the Hirogen, that would have been a really good... I would have loved to have seen an episode of the Hirogen with Worf. Like, I think Worf would have had a lot of fun, you know, fighting Hirogen. I mean, because I think the Klingons in general would be a good... I think they would love the Klingons.
Well, don't they get an opportunity to battle later on in Voyager when the Voyager team gives them, like, access to a holodeck?
Well, they don't give them access. I think they solve that. Eventually, the Hirogen, in another episode, it's a two-parter, the Hirogen take over Voyager and force the Voyager crew to fight them in the holodeck.
Oh.
Yeah. So, and that's another get off my ship episode, by the way. You might want to stop talking about that here.
Oh, there's a whole lot of those in Trek, as you mentioned at the beginning, and they're always great episodes. My head goes back to the episode where Picard has to take back the ship from, you know, the people when they're... The ship's getting scanned.
The Baryon sweep or whatever.
The Baryon sweep. And then attacks Tuvok with the...
Starship mine. It's funny, I was talking with Amy and Joe over on Galaxy Class about that episode a couple months ago, and... I always avoided that episode because I think I stated it on that. I get anxiety when enemy forces have taken over our ship. Now, I don't get it at all in this one because I don't have any stakes for the Prometheus. It's not my crew. It's not my ship. But, like, watching Basics Part 1 and 2 gives me such anxiety that I almost, like, skip it. And any sort of, like, losing our ship, it's been taken over type of, I don't know, I just... They're good, but I don't know. They're not my favorite kinds of episodes because I don't like seeing our heroes in that position.
Yeah, yeah.
But
then how they take it back. See,
yeah.
That's exciting.
I do like how they get Voyager back in Basics, too. But I need to just calm down sometimes when I'm watching things because it's like I get too personally invested. I'm like, no.
No, I hate
Get off
I
my ship.
You. Get off my ship. What do you think of that title? Is that a good title for the series?
It's perfect. It's perfect. You know, I don't know. You say get off my ship, and for whatever reason, I jump to the finale of Star Trek III where Kirk is down on Genesis fighting with Krug, and he's like, I have had enough of you, and he pushes, you know, he hits him in the face, and he falls into the lava pit and dies. But I don't know why that evokes that scene in my head. But it does.
Hey, that's great.
I have a very warped mind, pardon the pun. I just useless information stored up there.
Well, do you have any final thoughts for this week's episode?
Well, I would like, well, just not maybe a final thought. I thought the final battle was just amazing. Like, this was like really entertaining. You see two Defiant class vessels and a Akira class, which anyone who's ever played like Star Trek Armada 1 and 2, we just love those ships. But you see these three Starfleet vessels catch up to the Prometheus because the doctors have managed to stop the Prometheus. But then we also see three Romulan warbirds show up, which are just our standard, the Derridix class ships, which we saw way back from season 1 of TNG. get into this big battle, and the doctor, the commie, I mean, we're in a big battle here, and watching the doctors try to figure out how to, you know, run the tactic, you know, A, drive the ship or pilot the ship, and B, run the tactical systems is funny. They actually fire a torpedo and hit a Federation ship. And then, whoops, exactly. And then accidentally put the ship into multi-vector assault mode, which is ultimately how they win the fight. But I just thought, seeing a Federation-Romulan battle in Voyager is something you don't see every day, and maybe that's why it's a little bit more exciting to me. And when the two Starfleet officers beam on the ship at the end, and they're like surprised to see two EMHs running it, and I don't think those guys even had any lines to deliver. But I just like the way this episode wraps up, and then obviously the doctor gives Starfleet a full briefing about what's happened to Voyager, and they send him back. So, final thoughts for me. I love it. I just think it's a good episode. It's like you said, it's kind of a fun episode just to randomly watch sometime. It's kind of a comedy / feel good episode. It's high stakes, but it's not high stakes in some way. You see dead people on the ship, on the Prometheus and whatnot. There's some morbid things about this episode. The fact that, 27 Starfleet officers have been murdered. But it's just good fun, if that's even appropriate. What are your thoughts?
While you were talking, I thought of a nitpick, which was the multi-vector assault mode. How are they able to access it? Because they didn't have any power as EMHs. So is it because they were on the bridge were able to?
You're on the bridge, all power, everything was rooted to the bridge, I think they say early in the episode. And, they gassed all the Romulan guys, so they didn't get a chance to lock anything out. So you would expect that all the controls on the bridge and even the audio controls on the bridge were still functional. So... I don't have a problem there, but it is kind of convenient that he accidentally pushes multi-vector assault mode, and like that they wouldn't have any knowledge. I mean, maybe a potential little plot hole is that there's zero basic training putting in these EMHs that if they could do more than just be a doctor.
Yeah.
Including our own doctor, who has been on for 4 years at that point.
Yeah.
But other than that, it's funny. And I think it was designed to be funny, and that's why it works. But yeah.
Well, the two officers that beam on board were actually regulars, regular extras on Deep Space Nine. And they were the only people in the episode that didn't have to get refitted for their uniforms, because those were the uniforms they wore every day when they showed up for Deep Space Nine duty. So there's a little extra fun fact that I found.
That's really cool. It is really nice seeing the First Contact era uniforms being used here. I always thought it was, it was probably a cost item, but the fact that after communications has started going back and forth, and the Pathfinder episode and the Midas Array being used and things like that, that Voyager didn't just update the replicator for its uniforms and evolve into the updated movie era uniform. I thought that would have been a nice thing for their final two seasons to be in that newer First Contact uniform, because I love that uniform.
I really like the Voyager uniform. It's probably my favorite, which I don't own because I can't find that purple tunic anywhere, and I got to find the right purple in order to get the rest of it, and I can't find it anywhere. So if anybody or listeners out there,
I have one that's the wrong color, and then I had ordered one from Anovos and paid for it, and of course never got it because Anovos is shady. And now they changed their name, and they kept everybody's money.
Yeah. Well, that's no good.
Yeah. Not salty at all here, listeners.
Well, my final thoughts, as I say at the beginning, like, Doctor episodes on Voyager are some of my favorites. I love the comedy across the board on this episode. I love episodic episodes, go figure, where you can pop in and out, and this is a great, you know, great episode for that. Just put on, you know, if you're in the mood for a lighthearted Star Trek romp, it's got kind of a little bit of everything in there. And yeah, you know, the very last bit of the episode when you have the Doctor standing there with the captain and said, I have a message from Starfleet. You are not alone. You know, that just gives me all of the feels. You know, it has my, you know, my goosebumps. It is a really touching and special moment. Because, like I said, you know, on the one hand, there's a lot of heaviness to this episode, which they balance with the humor. But then you have this touching aspect as well at the end. It's just warm and fuzzy, like a big Star Trek hug.
And
I love it.
Yeah, it is. It lays the groundwork for Project Voyager, I think it's called. And we learn more about it, mm-hmm. I think, next in Pathfinder. I think they get some letters from home utilizing the same Hirogen array in the very next episode. And I think that's kind of what leads into the skirmish with the Hirogen in the next episode. But they do get their first batch of letters next. Yeah. You find out through that exchange between the Doctor and Janeway that Voyager had been declared officially lost 14 months prior to the episode. And so there was really nothing being done to, you know, 'cause they were all declared dead. So this was probably a good thing for a lot of people that, you know, they find out Voyager's not, and maybe good and bad. I think you find out like a lot more that, like, some people's romantic relationships had moved on because, you know, they thought people were gone. But I kind of like that the things that we see later in like 6 and 7 where they are talking to Starfleet a little bit more, and it kind of builds up to the ship getting home.
Yeah. Well,
I would have loved to have seen one more season of Voyager that was kind of like a year of being home, you know.
Example of, you know, a Star Trek series, you know, getting done the dirty on the last episode, like what happened with Enterprise. Here's another one where, like, the last episode was good, but, like, really, like, everybody just wanted more of it. Like, they wanted to see what happened, and it just got kind of squished.
It really only needed 5 minutes more just to kind of show a little bit more exposition, talking to Starfleet, you know, maybe showing the ship dock and you know, Starfleet brass coming on board and blah, blah, blah. Just or cut to, you know, 3 months later. And, you know, I think MASH had famously done something like that. When MASH finally ended on television, they showed all of the people who were at MASH in Korea at home, back in the United States or whatnot, and doing kind of settling back in. So, yeah. But I think it would even, like, there's some Voyager books that take place right after Voyager gets home. And it goes on to explain, like, you know, Starfleet put the ship in a space dock and started ripping it apart for information because all that Borg technology and upgrades that had been made to Voyager, they wanted to study them and things like that. And yeah, there's a lot like that that we just, yes, the novels have taken them on, but it would have been really cool to kind of see some of the fallout of Voyager getting home. Totally off topic, but there you go.
Well, Christos, what are we going to be discussing next week?
So next week's episode is the Shuttlecraft Series Part 3, Discoveries Lathe, or Lathe, whatever the pronunciation is of that, but that is a Season 1 episode of Disco. Got my Disco shirt on today. And it deals with Sarek being in a bad shuttlecraft accident.
Yeah. And then Michael has to use, I guess, her mental link with Sarek to board the ship telepathically and save him. I don't know, but it's a fun episode, and I like to rope in Discovery when I can. It is difficult because they're less episodic, but here's another one that kind of fits in the series, so we're gonna go and do that.
Definitely.
We'd love to hear what you thought of today's episode and hope you'll join our Facebook group, the BQN Collective, to continue our discussion there. You can also tweet your thoughts at AllGoodPod. We'd love for you to reach out. We love the interaction. Please follow the network on Twitter and Instagram at BQN Podcasts. Well, Christos, where can people find you when you're not teaching 7 of 9 to be more polite?
That would so be me, for people who really know me. You can find me in the BQN Collective on Facebook, as well as on Instagram and Twitter at GreekGeekSD. And Mark, where can people find you when you're not being decompressed and shot 60,000 years across the galaxy onto a ship that has been riddled with Romulans?
I love it, because if I was anybody on this show, it'd probably be the Doctor. Not just because I like him so much, but I can relate to his character. I get him. Anyway, Robert Picardo, if you're listening, I love you. Anyway, when I'm not doing that, you can find me at the BQN Collective on Facebook. You can also tweet at me at MarkWhite207. You can find me on It's Green. It's another show I host, which is Patreon exclusive. So if you become a patron of the network, you'll have access to that. Feel free to reach out in any of those ways. I love to talk to our listeners. And in the meantime, please hit the subscribe button on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a star rating and written review that helps others to find the show.
At this time, we'd like to thank our executive producers who make this all possible. They are Mr. Mark White, of course, Amy Nelson, Tony Robinson, and Ken Tripp. We'd also like to thank our associate producers, Mahedran Radhakrishnan and Tim Cooper. A special thanks to Tony Robinson and our artwork and for our artwork, excuse me, and Graham Kelly for our opening and closing music.
If you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Join the Hive to enjoy It's Green, Amy's Math Moments, and other network perks. With a monthly subscription of $5 or more, you can join our meetings on the Hive Mind on the second Saturday of each month. Visit patreon.com/BQN to get all the details and watch your messages. Thank you for listening, and we hope you'll join us as we search out
all good things. Will you stop breathing down my neck?
It's a holographic breath.
And it's a holographic neck.
Previously on BQN, All Good Things, a Star Trek Universe podcast.
As somebody that went through the D.A.R.E. program, I just feel in Nancy Reagan and all of that, like I grew up in that generation. And I've, as an adult, realized that, yes, there are people that abuse drugs, and drugs are not for everybody. But drugs are for some people.
Infinite Diversity, a Star Trek Universe podcast.
I love that Pike cooks with cast iron, because I truly could not imagine him using any other kind of pans.
I didn't even notice that.
It's just, that's that a very in-character thing for him to cook on, like, this, you know, seasoned cast iron. It's probably, like, 300 years old, and I'm sure, yeah.
Galaxy Class, a Star Trek The Next Generation podcast.
Wouldn't it be fun if we got a series that was like Star Trek JAG, where every episode was like a law, like some kind of legal case that ran up against Starfleet general orders or directives?
Yes! Oh my gosh, we need to have that!
Yeah.
You will find these and more of your favorite podcasts on BQN.